All right. Good morning, everyone. This hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 10:03 a.m. on Wednesday, January 13th, 2021. Today, I am chairing this telephonic meeting from Juneau. Members present on the line so far is myself, Representative Zelkowski, Chair. I did hear from Representative Drummond and Representative Swanholtz that they are otherwise occupied this morning, but look forward to watching back the archive of this meeting. I will identify other legislators as they join us on the line, and it looks like we also have Representative Clayman on the line. I'd like to begin by thanking our Juneau LIO staff for moderating today's meeting and making this audio conference possible. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. In late December, Governor Dunleavy and Commissioner Crum announced plans to split the Department of Health and Social Services into two new departments, a Department of Health and a Department of Family and Community Services. The announcement provided little details about the plan and what it might cost the state of Alaska, as well as impacts to stakeholders and those who utilize Department of Health and Social Services programs. We invited Commissioner Crum and the department to participate in today's hearing, but they declined to participate. Today, we have several testifiers joining us. We will be hearing from Amanda Mativier, Facing Foster Care Alaska, Lynn Biggs from Casey Family Programs, President Richard Peterson from Central Council, Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, Chief P.J. Simon with Tanana Chiefs Conference, Tammy Sandoval from Child Welfare Academy, and Jake Metcalf from the ASEA. We appreciate all of you being available for this important conversation and discussion about potential impacts to a reorganization of the department. First up, we will hear from Amanda Mativier with Facing Foster Care Alaska. If you could, please begin by introducing yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, you sound great.
Thanks. So for the record, my name is Amanda Mativier, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Facing Foster Care in Alaska, or FFCA. We're a statewide nonprofit of current and former foster youth. I'm also an alumni of foster care myself. I aged out of the system in Anchorage. I have a bachelor's and a master's in social work. I'm also a licensed foster parent now for about 13 years on and off. And I also work at the Child Welfare Academy, the Office of Youth Empowerment with foster youth across the state. And I serve on several committees and working groups at both the state level and national level on child welfare issues and efforts to reform. I just want to start by thanking you, Representative Zelkowski, for holding this hearing today to hear this issue. And members of the committee for really paying attention to this and what this means for children and families across the state. And I also wanted to acknowledge that I know we have a number of foster youth that are listening into this today as well, because this has a direct impact on their lives. And I think that for vulnerable children living in a state system that is in crisis during a global pandemic, talk of restructuring and reorganizing things is a little rattling, but especially for our young people who have been dealing with a lot of the repercussions related to COVID. So I actually want to speak specifically during my testimony today to the proposed bifurcation of the Office of Children's Services. So there's the larger proposed restructure of the Department of Health and Social Services, and splitting that and having multiple divisions within those new two new departments. There's also a proposed bifurcation of the Office of Children's Services into two separate divisions, the Office of Early Intervention and the Office of Family Services. And before I sort of dive into that piece of it, I want to highlight some of the challenges and just the state of our current system and the impacts of COVID, because I think that's really relevant for what's happening right now for children and families and those staff working in child protection and all the legal parties involved. This is a big proposal on the table for people who are just trying to get through the day-to-day and deal with all the things that come with the pandemic and the impacts on our state. I believe that the proposed bifurcation is coming from a place of good intent in trying to improve the system. I just don't think that it's the solution or fix in terms of gaining public trust, especially considering timing and just lack of input from stakeholders. So I think it's important to understand sort of like what is happening with the Office of Children Services right now, especially since COVID has hit. So I have the opportunity to work with young people across the state who are in foster care or making their transition out. And so I come into contact with about 300 young people a year. And it feels like since COVID hit, every day is a crisis. And it's crisis response to housing and basic needs type things. But I have spent a lot of time with young people everywhere who are just really struggling with the challenges of isolation and all that's happened since the pandemic has hit. So the goal of foster care, for people that aren't familiar with the system, is to get children out of the foster care system and into what's referred to as permanency within 12 to 24 months. So returning children back home to their parents when that's possible, placing them with relatives. If, you know, parents aren't an option, or keeping them, you know, within their tribe or home community. 65% of the over 3,000 children in foster care right now are Alaska Native. Or moving toward trying to find an adoptive home or a caregiver that can be a legal guardian long term, if those other efforts to find a return home with family or place with relatives fall through. And so within a two-year timeline. And since the pandemic has hit, children are just lingering in foster care. Everything has been stalled. Most state staff are working from home. To give you an overview, and I can send this out if people want this information. It's also public information on the OCS website under statistics. Over the past 12 months, OCS has lost 171 foster homes. And that doesn't include those that are on hold due to the pandemic. So a number of foster homes, because of health issues, maybe related to parents or their own family, fear of COVID, you know, coming into their home, they put themselves on hold. And I can tell you, as a someone who's licensed as a foster parent right now, I get calls almost daily, hearing just the desperation and the voice of caseworkers everywhere in the state. I live in Anchorage, and I hear from workers in Utqiagvik and Kenai and Fairbanks and Bethel. I typically take older youth, 16, 17, and I'm hearing for all age groups, for sibling groups, just, you know, the agency is really desperate to find homes for children. And so that has created an incredible challenge on top of just everything with their regular day-to-day casework. Visits between children and parents and siblings are mostly virtual right now. So for family contact between children and their parents, that's telephonic or it's over the internet, you know, through like FaceTime or Zoom. And that poses more challenges too, especially for maybe parents or even children in more rural areas that have, or don't have access to, they have, don't access to a phone. And so, you know, all the research points to visits between children and their parents early and often leads to more timely reunification. Visits with OCS caseworkers and children in foster care are also mostly virtual right now. This is happening somewhat in person and maybe more so on the front end for investigations, but for children in the system, we've heard from youth the most on this issue that they're not being seen every 30 days by a caseworker in their foster home. And this definitely creates potential for danger because you miss things. You miss smells. You miss sounds. You miss potential other people in the home. And children are further isolated when everything else is virtual. They have less contact with the outside world. So therapy right now is typically virtual. School in most communities is virtual. Doctor's appointment is virtual. And so we have heard from youth across the state just over and over, it seems like every day at this point, who are just really struggling with the isolation, who feel like they're forgotten, but also just don't have access to the outside world. Legal proceedings, so all the court hearings, team meetings that happen in OCS cases are also virtual or telephonic. So court is mostly telephonic, or some hearings are on Zoom. This is creating a number of delays, continuances, so further delaying children's time in foster care. Majority of both legal parties and, you know, a lot of us as staff are working from home, and then also dealing with if they're trying to help their own children with Zoom school or homeschooling. And then we've just seen for a number of our young people in transition across the state struggling to make that transition. So for older youth who have been making that transition out of foster care and into adulthood, doing that at a time where it's even harder than ever to secure housing, employment, transportation resources has created just immense challenges. So we as an organization actually started a COVID relief fund, and we have helped to support rental assistance and utilities and transportation, and most of this is well beyond after they've tapped other resources, for example, like through 211 or whatever the community that they live in offers. And we've mostly supported young parents who are just really on the brink. Like, they miss, you know, one rental payment, everything else sort of becomes this domino effect. So those are sort of the current challenges that our system is facing related to COVID. And I think it's important to sort of set the tone for what our system is experiencing as we're also talking about a further reorganization, this bifurcation of the division of OCS. I also wanted to highlight, every year we typically bring a group of foster youth down to the Capitol to educate lawmakers, but for also them to learn and experience and understand the important role of, you know, participating in government. And we're not going to be able to do that this year also because of COVID. But in 2018, we worked to pass a major reform bill. We came before this body for 2 years with mounds of evidence and data to support House Bill 151, because we know that languishing in foster care is damaging to children. The bill was really rooted in best practice and modeled off of a gold standard system out of New Jersey, where caseworkers are limited in their caseloads, so they can better respond to families. They're well-trained, so families receive the support and services they need to move children more quickly through the system, get them to permanency. That legislation, we're in year three of implementation. The most recent annual report to the legislature just came out in the fall, so it's supposed to go to all legislators on the progress of that. The most recent report also showed a slight jump in turnover for OCS staff, caseworkers, frontline staff, about 47% right now. But I think it's important to also highlight House Bill 151, because that was a major effort to overhaul the system. And in the work to try to move and pass that, the legislature wanted a lot of evidence that if they were going to invest in something this big, that they wanted to know it was going to work. And I haven't really seen much yet around the bifurcation in terms of evidence base. And so sort of moving on to the OCS bifurcation, and then I'll wrap up. So typically child welfare sort of has this culture of collaboration. People come together, and it's promoted really by experts as best practice, to bring in stakeholders, young people, parents, foster parents, community partners, tribes, really bringing everyone to the table to have conversation about, what works, what doesn't work, what direction to take in terms of change. And the decision to bifurcate OCS wasn't really made in the spirit of collaboration. I think for the most part, stakeholders, our organization, most groups were notified after the decision was made that this is going to move forward and it's going to roll out. And really the only sort of explanation that I know I got was around public trust, was that it was going to increase public trust to separate the division out into two separate divisions. But I think that there's still a lot of unanswered questions and things that really should be looked at or things to consider. especially as we're still in this rollout or this implementation timeline of House Bill 151. There's also the state has been working with the tribes for a number of years now on the compact to also provide services to families in child welfare. The state also has a program improvement plan they have to follow for the federal government. So there's a lot happening just in terms of OCS and how they're supposed to be operating and responding to all these policy changes and efforts with other agencies and organizations and the federal government, but also the impact of the pandemic. And so I think just in terms of timing with what's happening with the pandemic, is this the right time to move toward a bifurcation? I think other things to consider are what is the evidence base for this? Really trying to figure out or bring in experts to draw on, maybe from the Children's Bureau. I know Casey Foundation is going to talk today. Maybe Center for the Study of Social Policy. There is a ton of evidence out there and research that has been done around what works in child protection systems, and I think we should be drawing on that as we make decisions about how our system will operate. I think also taking into account that it's going to require families and legal parties to potentially deal with two separate agencies. So for children and parents that are already involved in the system, there are so many professionals involved, and it's hard to know whose role is what meeting you're going to, what court hearing you're going to, what professional you're talking to, and to then have to deal with multiple systems, I think could just be absolutely daunting. And really, child welfare is meant to be a continuum of families coming into the system because of child abuse and neglect, addressing those issues that brought them in an effort to try to bring children back to their home of origin or with their parents or into another permanent situation. One of the other things that I saw that was sort of laid out in the proposal for the bifurcation is to bring OCS back to four regions. Right now it's five regions across the state is the way it's broken up. And I know in the past it was actually the House Test Committee who took the recommendation from the Citizens Review Panel after they talked to frontline caseworkers across the state to be able to create that fifth region, the Western region. So I think a further look into that and the thinking behind moving back to four regions from five and if that is the right thing to do or not. And then also taking into account the cost of, you know, again, two separate divisions, two separate directors, two separate deputies, and staff beneath those. And then just overall, what is the impact going to be on children and families for anyone that's ever had to deal with any sort of public social service system? Government systems are really difficult to navigate. And so, again, dealing with two separate systems, I just think is going to be daunting for families. And the way that OCS is structured right now in urban areas, there already is sort of this internal, you want to call it a bifurcation. There's a unit that addresses investigation and assessment of families when reports come in, and it's usually referred to as IA. And then there's family services that deals with that further case planning with parents and trying to find permanency for children. That's in larger communities. In smaller communities, they do have generalist workers that maybe work a case all the way from the initial assessment through whatever the permanent plan is. And so I'm not sure how a bifurcation to separate it out into two divisions is any different than how in urban areas there's already sort of that internal split. So again, I just actually also wanted to highlight that I know we have foster youth on the call, and I think it's important that as they're listening in to highlight that being able to have this hearing and this opportunity to hear this issue, I think is super important to youth considering all that they're facing being in foster care right now. So I'm going to wrap it up, and I'm happy to be a resource to anyone on this committee, answer questions, send any of the information I cited. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mativier, for your advocacy for Alaska's youth, all of the investment of time that you personally gave to House Bill 151, and just the continued work that you do on behalf of Alaska's families. I want to acknowledge for the record that Representative Garantar has also joined us. So I'd like to turn to my legislative colleagues to see if committee members have questions for Ms. Mativier. All right, I'll just pending any additional questions from my colleagues, can you again highlight the number, you mentioned early in your testimony the number of Alaska Native children that are currently in the child welfare system, and are you able to speak to the disparity of services felt specifically by rural Alaska Native youth in the system?
Can you hear me?
Yep, you sound great.
Representative Zolkowski, I can, and if it's helpful to after this, I can also email on the exact data, which is also public information. It's typically on the OCS website, but there are 65% of Alaska Native or of children in foster care are Alaska Native. Definitely disproportionate, as we know that about they make up about 20% of our overall all child population. And I believe that in some communities, they make up 100% of the children that are in foster care and out-of-home care. I think that the challenges with the pandemic have been even greater for Alaska Native children and our state's ability to follow the Indian Child Welfare Act. Like I said, I'm getting calls from all across the state to take placement of children in foster care, and we know that there's a placement preference standard that we're supposed to be following under ICWA that says first you find relatives and you place with relatives, or you look within a tribe or a child's community, and then, you know, move to stranger foster care as a last-ditch effort. And I think just in sort of the desperation and lack of homes and people who are just really overwhelmed by all that's happening in the system, it's making it even harder to follow that. And then we see youth who do come from rural areas into more urban communities like Anchorage, or even the Mapsi Valley and Fairbanks, they're coming in to live in a foster home or maybe a residential program, and it's an even sort of further culture shock. Well beyond separation and the grief and the loss of being removed from their family. Now they've been removed from their community, and all they know and all that they're used to. And once that happens, I think we see even bigger challenges on the back end for those youth who then become adults and are transitioning out into the world, and have their own children and families, because then they're still dealing with the trauma and repercussions of what has happened in terms of being removed from their community. And especially if they lived in a community where they maybe lived a subsistence lifestyle or lived in a much smaller community. And so they come into urban areas, but especially in places like Anchorage. I mean, we see a lot of older youth who come in and are placed at the shelter downtown, Covenant House. And I think Covenant House does a great job and really tries to respond to the needs of youth. But when youth are placed in the heart of downtown in a shelter setting, they become even more vulnerable, especially when they're from a smaller community and they come to the city. And we know that the shelter is a target of traffickers for sex trafficking. We know that there's a lot of substance abuse and drug use. And so in some ways, we make them even more vulnerable. And again, we see that a lot with older youth as they're trying to make of the transition to adulthood, because they've lost their sense of identity and who they are related to their culture.
Thank you for that answer. And in a follow-up question, you'd mentioned in your testimony that concern that the decision was not made in a spirit of collaboration, and we know that there's the type of engagement where you invite people in to notify them of a decision that's being made, or there's the opportunity for meaningful consultation to really kind of work through and talk through the impacts and evaluating evidence-based information. Can you talk a bit about what the type of engagement was like that occurred prior to the announcement, and a bit more about your involvement in discussions following the announcement of reorganizing, the intention to reorganize the department and even down into the division of OCS?
I guess I have heard sort of like, you know, remnants that DHSS would be announcing this big reorganization. The day before the announcement, I did get a call from Commissioner Crum to notify us that they would be making that announcement the following day. But that's when I first learned of the OCS, the proposed OCS bifurcation. And he mentioned that I only talked to him briefly, and I think his intentions were genuine and were good in letting me know so that young people would know that this is coming and it wasn't going to be a surprise. But I haven't really gotten much information post that. I saw the proposed org chart that outlines the OCS bifurcation and the two separate divisions. And then a member of our board president, Angel Gonzalez, participated in the following weeks with the tribal state collaboration group with OCS and tribes and others, and sort of learned more about what that looks like and then just relayed the information. But there hasn't been any effort to directly engage young people, youth in that process. I've heard the same from folks that work with mostly like with birth parents, foster parents. So we've sent this information out so that older youth know that it is a recommendation, but I think it's been just sort of ensued some panic among young people who, like I said, are already feeling isolated and are already struggling with all the impacts of the pandemic. And in the past, when big changes have come, or, you know, there's been an effort to try to make change, typically OCS or the department, the larger department, may, you know, hold some sort of like community forum or meeting to talk through ideas with all the key stakeholders to generate ideas, to get that expert information, to collect data and research, but to also hear back from just the community that's involved and have just really courageous conversations, the good and the bad. And I think in this case that didn't really happen. It was just sort of like a notification to everyone that this decision was made and is happening. And so I think we all sort of took it as a shock.
Thank you for that answer. I do, again, want to acknowledge that the department and the commissioner were invited to participate in today's meeting but declined the opportunity to participate. And subsequently, the department has shared a letter dated January 6th that the proposed timeline for bifurcating OCS was delayed from the July 1st timeframe, and that there's intention of the department to begin a consultation process in February of 2021. That being said, Ms. Mativier, I was hoping you could talk a bit more. You talked about the current conditions of the Department of OCS, and we see in the significant disparity of Alaska Native youth in the system, just the challenges that the department has had. And in my brief time in the legislature, there's been a constant struggle about or around continuity of caseworkers and people that work within the system and the challenging environment that that work plays. I was hoping you could talk a bit more about your perspective on impacts of such a significant reorganization amidst a department that's challenged in meeting its current mission.
Representative Zolkowski, thanks. I think that doing something at this level to propose such a big shift and to split the division at this point, like I said, most people are working from home. And so to go through such a big undertaking during all that's happening with COVID and just, you know, current challenges with family and all public service systems, the timing is, I would say, not the best, because it's even harder to sort of solicit input. Maybe that happens through Zoom. I know that I've heard from a number of caseworkers too at OCS and frontline staff who are also really worried about this and what this looks like. I think also because they want the opportunity to participate and give input, but also are still struggling to complete their daily work because of, you know, just, again, the impacts of COVID, the lack of placement options for children in the system, everything being virtual, them potentially working from home and trying to homeschool their own children. Just there's, like, a lot of factors that are coming into play right now. But I think also, like, further the department looking into, like, what does that really mean? Because the reason for the bifurcation or the proposed bifurcation that I was given was that it was about public trust. And I think it's obvious. I think most people know that the public doesn't trust child protection, but this is not an Alaska specific issue. This is everywhere. This is an agency that has a lot of authority over families to make decisions around removal, but also has to have that authority because of child abuse and neglect. And so it's hard to instill trust in the public for an agency that can come in and remove someone's child. But I can tell you most of the caseworkers and people at OCS don't come in and want to damage and tear apart families. They come in because they care and they want to make a difference and they want to work with families. And I think in terms of public trust, I mean, we know that people connect to people. They don't connect to programs. And so it's really about relationship. And so you can split the division in two and slap a fancy new name on each side of it. But I don't know that that's going to change the way that the public looks at it, especially the arm that does the assessment and investigation of child abuse and neglect. I think it's bigger than that. And I think a part of also building public trust is engaging with stakeholders, engaging with the community around big decisions like a bifurcation.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mativier. Before we move on, I want to check in with my fellow committee members to see if they have any questions. All right. Thank you so much for your testimony this morning and, again, for all the work you do with Alaska's children. If you don't mind staying on the line, if there are additional questions throughout the hearing, we would certainly appreciate that.
I can do that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We will now hear from Lynn Biggs with KC Family Programs. There is a presentation available for download from BASIS. Visit www.akledge.gov to access. Ms. Biggs, if you could introduce yourself for the record and provide your testimony, and if you can, please advise the next slide as you move through your presentation.
I will do so. Thank you very much, Representative Kolosky and committee members, for this opportunity. My name is Lynn Biggs, and I am a senior director with KC Family Programs and also a strategic consultant. And I have an MSW degree and have worked with KC for over 32 years. And the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of working with state, tribes, and others, including Faith and Foster Care in Alaska, So I have provided a PowerPoint that hopefully you all have. I will probably not address everything on every slide because there is a lot of information here. But I will start off by talking about who we are, who KC Family Programs is. And we are the nation's largest operating foundation that's been focused on safely reducing the need for foster care and building communities of hope for children and families. And we began in 1966. Our founder was Jim Casey, the founder of United Parcel Service. We have worked to influence long-lasting improvements to the safety and success of children, families, and the communities where they live. We currently operate in all 50 states, D.C., Puerto Rico, and Virgin Islands. We have our Indian Child Welfare Program has direct agreements with 16 tribes, and three of those are in Alaska, Tulare'ak, Tlingit Haida, and Tanana Chiefs Conference. We have 9 field offices who also provide direct services to youth in care. Next slide. As Casey Family Programs, we have been working and investing in Alaska since the year 2000. And in doing so, we have worked with tribes, state, philanthropic organizations, university, based in foster care in Alaska, and others to affect positive, improved outcomes for Alaskan children and families. Another piece of work done is sponsored statewide efforts to address adverse childhood experiences in Alaska and to safely reduce the need for foster care. Next slide. Last week at Tribal State Collaboration Group, there was a presentation that was given about called The Mechanisms of American Indian and Alaska Native Inequality in Child Welfare Across the United States. This was presented by researchers Dr. Frank Edwards, who's from Rutgers University, and Dr. Teresa Rocha Beardall, who's from Virginia Tech. There was a lot of data given, but I wanted to draw your attention to two pieces of data that were really striking for Alaska. And one is that an Alaska Native infant age 1 or younger has a 15% chance of being the subject of a child abuse and neglect investigation, highest in the nation. The second one was an Alaska Native child has an 80% chance of being the subject of a child abuse and neglect investigation by age 18, also the highest in the nation. And it's because of the disproportionality that's been talked about and is well known in Alaska that we have actively supported efforts to reduce disproportionality of Native children in foster care in Alaska. We have also sponsored the Alaska Strategic Plan that runs from 2016 to 2020, which was titled To Transform Child Welfare Outcomes for Alaska Native Children. And that really was a forerunner of the Alaska Tribal State Child Welfare Compact. And we continue to be strong supporters of that and believe that full implementation of that would help with the disproportionality issue and so many others as far as the facing Alaska. And then we also participate in Alaska's longstanding tribal-state collaboration group. So those are some of the pieces of work that we have been involved with. Next slide. I just wanted to provide just some information from around the country as far as there are different ways that states have states administer child and family services through lots of different configurations. One is a multiple cabinet level agency. One is a single consolidated health and human service agency. And then various agency combinations of child welfare, juvenile justice, early childhood, behavioral mental health, substance abuse, prevention and treatment, public health, and financial assistance. The research shows that there's really no evidence of an ideal organizational structure. And as you know, governors and state legislatures have long reorganized state agencies in an effort to improve outcomes. The research is lacking, but the limited research that does exist and extensive state experience does tell us that there is no ideal structure. Every approach has pros and cons. Positive child and family outcomes cannot be attributed to a particular model. No research evidence proves accountability or service quality occurs with reorganization. An organizational climate and culture, low conflict, cooperation, role clarity may contribute more to outcomes than interagency coordination structures. Next slide, please. So, again, I don't think I'm going to go in great detail through all of this. You can see for yourself the pros and cons from a single consolidated health and human services agency. Also, you can see there are many states who have a cabinet-level child and family agency. The scope, configuration, and age vary enormously. And just to for those who don't have a PowerPoint, some of the state agencies that have this are Arizona, Illinois, Massachusetts, Mississippi, Indiana, Tennessee, New Mexico, Rhode Island, Washington, and New Jersey. Next slide. And then states with a child and family agency also are Connecticut, Delaware, Wisconsin, Florida, Wyoming, and Vermont. So there's plenty of examples around the country to take a look at in the lessons learned. And then there's a list of the pros and the cons that each one has, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time looking at that. But I did want to highlight Washington State, because it's an example of the most recent reorganization that has occurred in a state. And it actually began in 2016 when the governor created a Blue Ribbon Commission to recommend the organizational structure for new cabinet-level departments focused solely on children and families. It was co-chaired by a key legislative committee chair and a judge. Members included state legislators, tribal representatives, administrators of existing programs, court administrators, state employee unions, and issue experts. And for 9 months, this commission studied other state models and developed guiding principles and desired outcomes for the new department and considered tribes and other stakeholder input data and financing approaches. Next slide. Some of the lessons learned is how important it is to review existing data. And there's a lot of data that Alaska could use to take a look at to determine the agency priorities and desired outcomes for Alaska Native and other Alaska children and families. And determines the needs. Consider how the priorities and the desired outcomes should drive the structure. Reorganization cannot provide support for needed reforms. Involve tribes, communities, and those with lived experience in planning from the beginning and throughout organization. In Alaska, particularly, the involvement and inclusion of the tribes at every step of the way is essential through tribal consultation. And again, last week at the Tribal-State Collaboration Group, there was a presentation made, and there was considerable dialogue between the state and the tribes about this. And I think there is a realization how much the tribes need to be involved and included every step of the way. Also, another lesson learned is to ensure that agency resources are aligned with desired outcomes, build on and expand existing strengths, successes, and capacity, like the state tribal compact, like prevention, like family strengthening. And the transition to a new structure typically takes 2 to 5 years, 1 year or more for preparing and planning, up to 5 years for implementation. And implementation science also tells us that, too. Targeted efforts are necessary to sustain the momentum and support for change. Also, other lessons learned is reorganization is usually disruptive to some extent. And as Amanda noted, during a pandemic is really adds to the complexity of all of this. It's really important to have a shared vision, clear direction, necessary resources for planning and implementation. Plan carefully for separation from a single consolidated health human services agency. Ensure that the resources are adequate. There's no evidence or experience that new structures save money. Instead, there are additional costs associated with the organization, reorganization process, and often with new infrastructure. During the transition, it may be necessary to allow for possible redundancy. Strong leadership, continuous improvement systems, and accountability mechanisms are important, regardless of structure. So in closing, I guess I would just say, in Alaska, there is much work to be done, and Casey Family Programs is most interested in improving outcomes for children and families, and to see the disproportionality be reduced, finally. There have been so many efforts that have occurred to try to help this occur, and it hasn't. I do believe that Alaska is so fortunate to have strong, capable, effective tribes and people that are willing and able to take care of their own children in their communities and in their villages. And I do believe that the full implementation of the Tribal State Compact is a very helpful pathway toward the kind of transformation and improved outcomes that the state of Alaska is looking for. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Biggs, for your testimony today. Are there any questions from committee members at this time? All right, I do have a question, Ms. Biggs. Near the end of your presentation, I think slide 13, it discusses that a transition ideally takes 2 to 5 years. Has there been any evidence that identifies the impacts to outcomes for children and families that may be experienced during this transition timeframe?
Well, I believe that it puts children and families really at more risk. You know, the impact on children and families, the uncertainty in Alaska right now with the turnover rate is around 48%. There's already a lot of uncertainty and instability, add in the pandemic. And so I think during such a transition that the impact is a negative one on children and families.
Thank you. Before we move on to our next testifier, I just want to check in one more time with my colleagues to see if they have questions. All right. Thank you again for being with us today, Ms. Biggs. If you wouldn't mind, please stay on the line in case there are follow-up questions later in the meeting.
All right. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Now we will turn to President Richard Peterson from Tlingit and Haida. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, you sound great.
Great. Good morning. Representative Zolkolsky, members of the House Health and Social Services Committee, Gunapchish Hawa, for the opportunity to come speak with you today about the proposed reorganization of the Department of Health and Social Services. My name is Chahia Ish, Richard Peterson, and I currently serve as the president of Central Council of Tlingit Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. Tlingit Haida is the largest tribe in Alaska with over 32,000 enrolled tribal citizens across the state of Alaska, nation, and the world. The proposed changes to DHSS impact the tribe significantly in more than just one area. It is hard to talk about the division of DHSS and not discuss negative impacts to our tribal programs. Tribal programs span across the department, each one connected to the other as we serve children and families. We recognize each division has a tremendous task, yet our families, whether they are in a 24/7 facility or receiving prevention services, are all connected. Tlingit Haida has partnered with the State of Alaska Department of Health and Human Services and OCS for many years to better serve our children and families. More specifically, Tlingit Haida is really proud to be one of the tribes that signed the historic compact with OCS in 2017, which took many years of consultation and cooperation to achieve. Tribes have demonstrated a willingness to put in the hard work to develop a child welfare compact already, recognizing 65% of the children in custody are Alaska Native. We would hope any changes at OCS would not undermine the current compact or the process in which it was created, a true government-to-government relationship. Expanded compacting with tribes could be a win-win for both the state and for the children and families served by OCS. It was created as a model for other state departments to follow when working with tribes. We would ask the state to consider and include tribes when planning to elevate the Child Welfare Compact to the Office of the Commissioner in the spirit that it was created. It is unclear if the compact will be elevated to the Commissioner's office. If it was, who would oversee the compact if it were at the Commissioner's office? This person would need to be familiar with working with tribes, child welfare, and still have direct connection to the day-to-day operations at OCS. The rationale given by the Office of the Commissioner to split DHSS and, quote, the department is huge. It is hard to get the time needed in front of the legislature, budget considerations, and it will make the department easier to manage. I would say as an alternative, by engaging tribes and community stakeholders familiar with the work, more cost-efficient alternatives could be found to address the issues cited rather than split the department into two. There appear to be duplications between the divisions and administrative operations in both the DHSS and OCS divisions. It seems like it would be far more costly. The time to find a new commissioner, directors, and staff will be a challenge. The state struggles to fill the vacancies currently, leaving many of our programs and families not receiving the attention they deserve. Our tribes are focused on the whole person and family. As more and more departments are working singularly and not holistically with the DHSS, who will be looking at the whole family and client person? Are we looking to better serve the family or making changes for reasons other than that? Lastly, I'd like to stress the importance of tribal consultation before significant changes like these are being made. As mentioned, the tribes partner with DHSS to provide holistic services to our shared citizens. We stand ready to engage in consultation with DHSS, especially regarding any proposed changes to how the state addresses child welfare. Tribal consultation and the creation of such an impactful change could make the conclusion stronger and more effective. The governor has an obligation to consult with tribes based on DHSS policy that remains in effect. We hope that he will honor that and invite us to the table to help make future decisions. I also want to stress that I believe that it's through systemic racism that's gotten us to where we're at. The fact that 65% of the children in the care of the state of Alaska are Alaska Native is reflective of that. And I think that will only get worse if we're not involved. Again, thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective. Tlingit Haida stands committed to partnering with the state. We look forward to the opportunity to engage further in the process to fix the system.
Liana, thank you for your testimony today, President Peterson, and all of the work that you do on behalf of tribes in Alaska. I'd like to ask my committee members, my colleagues, if they have any questions for President Peterson at this time. All right, I do have a couple of questions. President Peterson, can you discuss the status of the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact? Particularly, can you speak to what was previously proposed for expanded scopes of work with Alaska's tribes? Have those been pursued, and has there been related funding agreements to ensure that there's the levels of support needed for tribes to be successful in those scopes of work through the compact?
Madam Chair, I would have to defer to my staff on that. Mary Johnson represents us in the compact, and I can find that out and get back to you.
Yeah, that would be great. Would appreciate that when you get it. And then just in your experience with advocacy, and the role that you play in consultation for your tribe, what level of engagement has the department had in the existing compact?
I think at times it can be difficult. I think we're working hard to get through those. We met with Commissioner Crum as part of the working group last week. And I stressed, coming to the table and telling us a decision that's already been made really isn't consultation. It's not, you know, doesn't fit government-to-government consultation at all. Again, I stress the fact that 65% of the children in state care are Alaska Natives. So we really should be in the discussions at the beginning rather than being told what the outcome is.
Yeah, thank you for that. And similar to the question that I asked, particularly as an advocate for Alaska Native children and families, but also just Alaska children and families that may live in your particular service area, as we heard from Ms. Biggs during her presentation, transitioning to new structures can ideally take 2 to 5 years. Can you talk about your experience and what you've seen on the ground with families that are currently in these programs, in these systems, and any thoughts about impact to their experience and well-being through a transition process like this?
Well, my concern, Representative Zokolski, is that currently, you know, they're wanting to do this division because it's so difficult to administer now. Well, what's going to happen while they're trying to figure it out? I'm worried about the children and the families that are going to fall in between the cracks. And, you know, when we're talking about these formative years of our children, we don't have 5 years to figure it out. We don't have 1 year to figure it out. This needs to be figured out before it's implemented. And I just don't trust that it has been.
Thank you for that. And just in a final question for me, you mentioned the impact of institutional inequity and structural racism. Can you talk a little bit about what that means and the impact that you see it having on Alaskans through families that may need to utilize programs like this?
Well, I think the systemic racism goes back. It's part of that intergenerational trauma that was created through colonization, boarding schools, religious organizations. And so that's passed down. And now, you know, when you have a system that's not made up of our people, it can continue, right? And so I think that the solution is to have, you know, compacting and having us be the solution. I think we are the solution, and I think compacting is a way that we can better serve our families and assure that the systemic racism doesn't continue. And I don't think sometimes that systemic racism isn't intentional, but it's what happens when you don't know and you don't understand. Alaska is a diverse area. Our communities were made up of diverse people, and I think if the institution serving our people doesn't reflect the people it serves, that unintentionally you're going to see that systemic racism continues.
Definitely. And I can't help but think of former Lieutenant Governor Davidson's mantra of nothing about us without us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, Representative Zokolski, you know, I think there's an opportunity for us to work in partnership on solutions. And I think given the opportunity, we can do that, right? I think having true consultation with the governor's office, with Commissioner Crum, I think we could really develop what real solutions look like. But I really believe if it continues the way it has, that's just not going to happen.
Thank you so much, President Peterson, for being with us today. If you don't mind staying on the line in case there are follow-up questions later in the meeting, we would really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We will now turn to Chief P.J. Simon from Tanana Chiefs Conference. If you could introduce yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Good morning, Representative Zolkowski. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, you sound great.
Yes. My name is P.J. Simon. I was recently elected as the Chief Chairman of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. And TCC is a nonprofit intertribal consortium of 37 federally recognized Indian tribes and 41 Alaska Native communities, which is located across interior Alaska, including Fairbanks. TCC serves 16,000 Alaska Natives living in Fairbanks and in the rural villages located along the 1,400-mile-long Yukon River and its tributaries. TCC's service area encompasses 235,000 square miles, which is about the size of Texas. TCC's members utilize services from every division of the Department of Health and Social Services and are disproportionately represented as beneficiaries of many of these programs. We are a co-signer to the state of to the Alaska Tribal Health Compact and the Alaska Tribal Welfare Compact. And our employees have worked alongside state personnel through many administrations on various work groups and collaborations. We will necessarily be impacted by the administration's proposal to split the department, and so we are willing to work with the commissioner to achieve the best results for Alaska. Thank you to the committee for taking the time to listen to me speak about the impact this proposal will have on service delivery for this region and the state as a whole. We do not support the proposed division of DHSS as it would place a separation between programs and services that are necessarily intertwined. For instance, the proposed separation of the Office of Children's Services and the Division of Public Assistance and Division of Behavioral Health is baffling. How will OCS support families in a time of crisis without working with the divisions that have the resources to provide wraparound services? Office of Children's Services must provide active efforts to prevent the breakup of tribal families, and those efforts nearly always include counseling, support to provide safe homes and environments with the safe homes and other services operated by the divisions that would remain in the proposed Department of Health. Similar comments could be made about the Division of Juvenile Justice, which is placed within DHSS, based on the understanding that these youth, Alaska Native youth, need behavioral health intervention. And what is the justification for splitting the Alaska Pioneers Home from the Division of Senior and Disability Services? The proposed split of the department is not at all responsive to the relationship that necessarily exists between these various divisions and the services they provide. TCC is both a health and social service agency. It is a one-stop shop for our tribal members. One system makes sense because we are able to provide holistic, wraparound, and patient-centered services. At TCC, there is more efficiency and less bureaucracy. We achieve less overhead and a reduction in positions by keeping services under one roof. If a patient presents at the clinic and has a food security issue, the case manager is able to contact our client services division and connect the patient with the necessary services. If a parent is a party to a tribal child protection action, the tribe is able to connect the parent to the necessary health assessments and follow-up services. If a client currently benefits from assistance, TCC is able to connect the client with employment and training or educational services to step down from government assistance. The department's frequently asked questions indicates this change is being made to streamline the focus of the Department of Health and to make meaningful interventions for those Alaskans who are experiencing crises or are supporting their loved ones. It is unclear how this proposal will meet either objective, especially in a time when our state budget is in crisis. The frequently asked questions document explains that there will be better delivery of essential services, unquote, thanks to the use of statistics and data analysis, and proposed to create a new health analytics data and information systems within the proposed Department of Health. Again, there is no information on how additional data analysis or this new unit will lead to better health care delivery. The department already collects and maintains a broad array of data about health programs and has ready access to tribal partner data and analysis through our tribal epicenter. If the department wants to hire a consultant to help analyze that data in a new way, it can certainly do so. But that goal doesn't seem to justify the creation of a new department, which means a new commissioner plus staffing and facility costs related to that new commissioner's office, a new finance and management division to support the department, additional strain on the state's existing generalized administrative services to support the new department, and the creation of a new health analytics unit. More importantly, all these new units, staff, and needs cost money. Money the state simply does not have right now. For the past few years, our state has been in a crisis due to declining oil revenues and the insufficiency of other revenue sources to support basic state services. Year after year, we have suffered mass budget cuts, including large-scale cuts championed by this administration, and have been told that people need to accept reductions in services as a reality given the state fiscal situation. Yet, in the midst of this financial environment, the administration seeks to separate the department, create parallel and duplicate administrative structures, add a new unit, and add a new commissioner's office. This does not make sense and will lead to larger cuts in services down the road. TCC seeks to work with the commissioner to ensure any reorganization of DHSS benefits Alaska, DHHS. The frequently asked questions claims the proposed reorganization will amount to minimal additional cost. Since all of the units already exist, but as noted above, the new commissioner's office does not already exist. The new financial and management division does not already exist. And the new health analytics unit does not already exist. These costs will be more than minimal. The frequently asked questions also says the entire goal of the proposed reorganization is to provide services to Alaskans better and more efficiently. How is creating a duplicate department efficient? How will this lead to better services if funds are diverted from actual services to administration? The administration says its proposed reorganization is meant to improve services, but it does not explain how. It separates programs and facilities from the divisions that provide the services and resources to support these programs. Although the press releases focus on efficiency, one can't help but notice that the programs in the new Department of Family and Community Service are those the administration has tried to privatize or place on the chopping block in the past. It is time the state provide these programs with the support they need. Stabilize their leadership and operations and stop trying to pass responsibility onto someone else or expecting a private operator to do better. In conclusion, Canada Chiefs Conference does not support the proposed reorganization and believes it would lead to worse outcomes than the status quo. Canada Chiefs Conference is happy to collaborate with the state on ways to actually improve outcomes, increase efficiency, and strengthen service delivery, and hopes it and other tribes around the state are adequately consulted before future similar proposals are announced. Thank you, Representative Zolkowski, for your time in allowing us to provide the input on this proposal.
Thank you so much for your testimony today, Chief Simon, and your service to Alaska. Before I ask a question, I wanted to check in with committee members to see if there are any questions from committee members at this time.
Chair Zolkowski, this is Representative Tarr.
Representative Tarr, go ahead.
Thank you. I just appreciate the comments. Thank you. And I just also had the reaction that was just shared in terms of noticing that the split includes items that have previously been on the chopping block or considered for privatization, and then the other, programs left in the agency. So I shared that reaction and was just interested that was just also shared here in the committee today. And I think it's something we need to keep in mind as we're sort of exploring the philosophy behind this proposal. Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Tarr. And it worries me, Representative Tarr and Madam Chair, that with the current status quo of the pandemic and even with the Office of Children's Services, we do not want to have something like this happen. Being a first chief of a tribe, I know full well the tribal courts, the meetings with families, separating families, and that's tough enough already. And we would appreciate with the tribes that I serve in the team TCC that we serve, having this division only complicates our complicated service, trying to deliver a high level of service in remote location in a non-standard fashion. I yield my time back to Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief Simon. Sorry, Representative Tarr, did you have a follow-up? All right. Chief Simon.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Chief Simon, you had talked about the importance of meaningful consultation, particularly as an agency provider, a tribal agency provider that works in tandem with the state of Alaska and complements much of its work. Can you talk about the experience that TCC had in consultation with the department, with the governor, in the lead up to this particular announcement? TCC involved in the discussion, the deliberation related to this proposal?
Madam Chair, none.
All right. Thank you so much again for being with us today.
May add one more thing, Madam Chair. In years past, in dealing with OCS, in taking children, boys and girls from homes, we went to meetings with Cindy Lockton, ran OCS, and I've always thanked her for her time from our tribes to her, because OCS is such a difficult department to run. It's taken kids from
family, all they know, and putting them somewhere else. So it's a tough go all the way around, and with this split, it would make it even harder. So thank you again, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much again for being with us today. Please stay on the line in the event that there are
your line is muted.
Questions.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Now we will turn to hear from Tammy Sandoval from the Child Welfare Academy. If you could, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tammy Sandoval. Thank you for inviting me to testify on this important matter. So mostly all the good stuff was already talked about, but I wanted to let you know that while the testimony was going on, I got the specific data from OCS regarding the number of children in care. This month is 3,057, and 1,988 of those children are Alaska Native. I come before you as an expert in child welfare, having begun my career on the front lines some 37 years ago. I have a master's of social work, have worked in child welfare in three different states, done consultation and training in many others, and served as the OCS director from 2005 to 2010. Since that time, I have been the director of the Child Welfare Academy, the agency within UAA that trains all of the new OCS workers, social service associates, and supervisors, as well as stakeholders statewide. I've taken time off this morning in order to provide this testimony, and my opinions are those of my own, and I am not testifying as an employee of UAA or the Child Welfare Academy. Like so many outside of the state system, I was shocked to learn that DHSS was planning to split OCS into two divisions. While I tend to be someone who loves the idea of innovation, all I could think about was how this split would affect children, youth, and families, as well as the workers that serve those families. I have given this a great deal of thought, and I cannot see a way to make it work for those most affected, families and frontline workers. A family having to negotiate one system is nearly impossible as it is, but two divisions, not a chance. The child welfare system isn't just OCS. It's court parties, service providers, and with 65% of the children being in state custody, Alaska Native, it's tribal agencies as well. A family who is in crisis having to figure out who does what in two divisions instead of one, debilitating. And perhaps the worst thing about this proposal, it came out without stakeholder input, seemingly like it was a done deal. And what about parents and youth themselves? I'll bet if they were asked, they would have plenty to say about how best to design a system to better prevent the need for intervention, serve them when they do, and create efficiencies in the process. Was there consumer input?
Your line is unmuted.
Because in my vast career, I have never heard of a state splitting themselves such as what is being proposed. I did a quick Google search and only found one state that has tried it in the past. But in 2001, the Nevada State Legislature said that their bifurcated system was not conducive to promoting positive outcomes for children and families. I agree with wanting families to be served in a respectful, efficient way by caring OCS staff, but to split the system only contributes to the chaos and the hoops to jump through. Let's instead deal with the real issues. First and foremost, not enough resources to prevent the need for child welfare to begin with, inequities among disadvantaged people, and the lack of a workforce in Alaska to provide necessary services to those who need it. Those are some of the most pervasive reasons, quote, OCS doesn't work, end quote. In my experience, reorganization almost never works to fix the real issues. Bifurcation is just smoke and mirrors. Not enough child maltreatment prevention efforts, lack of workforce, and social inequities will racial inequities will still be the elephant sitting in the middle of the state left unaddressed. For the sake of those things that are going well now in the midst of a worldwide pandemic, I sincerely hope that this doesn't happen. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of children, youth, and families of Alaska.
Thank you for your testimony today, Ms. Sandoval. I'd like to check in to see if there are any questions from members of the committee at this time. Thank you, Ms. Sandoval, for your testimony. If you don't mind, please stay on the line in the event that there may be follow-up questions. All right, finally, we will turn to Jake Metcalf from the Alaska State Employee Association. Mr. Metcalf, if you could begin by introducing yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Chair Zukowski and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak about this today. My name is Jake Metcalf, and I'm the executive director for the Alaska State Employees Association, AFSCME Local 52, which is one of the largest public employee unions that represents both state and municipal employees in Alaska. They have more than 8,000 members that work across the state wherever Alaska needs them. As it relates to this topic, we have members that work in the Department of Health and Social Services, including the Alaska Pioneer Home, Alaska Psychiatric Institute, McLaughlin Youth Center, among other facilities. Our members also work for the Office of Children's Services and the Division of Public Assistance, making sure that Alaska families and children are safe and have the resources they need across the state. Department of Health and Social Services is our where we have most of our members. The largest number of our members are in that department. These public employees deliver essential public services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. They do incredible work in all kinds of climates, and even during the global pandemic. I think it's important to note that public service is more than a job. It's a passion, a calling, and a commitment to serving Alaska and Alaska communities. Our members are dedicated Alaskans working for Alaska. We've reached out to our members to share feedback and questions or concerns that they might have regarding the governor's proposal. Like others, we don't have a lot of clarity about this proposal or how it will impact the dedicated public workers in this department. I would note from listening to the testimony of the other folks here that we are in agreement that there wasn't any consultation bringing together folks to ask their opinions before this happened. We were told about this after it happened. I want to make sure it's clear to committee members and the administration who, as I understand it, chose not to be here today, which is a major disappointment, that our organization supports any efforts to improve services and efficiency, so long as the changes abide by the contract that we have, what's called the collective bargaining agreement, and that we signed with the state and the state signed, and so long as those changes are not at the expense of working people, or I think most importantly, to the detriment of Alaska's children, men and women, that need these essential public services. Finally, these changes must not come at the detriment of Alaska, and I'll explain that. Our members and our organization are concerned that the administration may be setting this department up for outsourcing these essential services. If this were to happen, this work would leave Alaska. It would undoubtedly impact the quality of services, which are sensitive in nature and require local-based knowledge for the administration of services. Let me give you a little background why we're worried about that. Our members work at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Our members work at the Alaska Pioneer Homes all over the state. Our members work in the Department of Health and Social Services and have a lot to do with making sure we're tracking the spread of the pandemic. We've seen those services contracted out over the length of this administration. They've attempted to do that with the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. We unfortunately had to resort to litigation to stop that from happening. The Pioneer Home has seen its cafeteria workers privatized, and you know there's concern that they want to privatize more of the services that they provide to our seniors. And most recently, we have seen this administration go out and outsource work regarding the pandemic. And unfortunately, they have not followed our contract to do any of that. And that's, you know, that's a really serious concern because we have an agreement. We're a business partner with the state. And outsourcing and subcontracting can happen if the administration does what it's supposed to under our contract and has a study, gets input from everybody, engages with its stakeholders. But they never chosen to do that. And instead, they want to go out and just outsource this work. And when it comes to areas like health and social services and children's services, you know, that's especially important when you have a government-to-government relationship like President Peterson talked about and Chief Simon talked about. You don't have that anymore when those services go to a multinational corporation that's not located in Alaska. The other thing about outsourcing this work is you don't have people running those services that have the local knowledge that they need. And, you know, I'm born and raised in Alaska. I've worked in rural Alaska. I grew up in Juneau, and now I live in Anchorage. And it is extremely important that you know the cultures of our state, that you know the local ways of doing things. And when you outsource work, especially this kind of family work, you don't have that anymore. In addition to outsourcing problems, you have the work going to private companies that don't provide benefits. And when you have an economy like we do, which has Chief Simon and Mr. Peterson talked about, we need jobs to stay here. We need jobs to have benefits so people aren't going on public assistance and that they have health care, especially during a pandemic. We have no control over that when work is outsourced. And, in fact, in most cases when work is outsourced, you don't have the benefits that follow along that those employees have as public employees. You know, we've seen this issue pop up with telework. We really think telework is important for the safety of employees. And, in fact, we encourage the state and engaged in litigation to make telework happen faster. And, you know, to the state's credit, after the litigation was implemented, they sped up their telework process. And I think that was for the safety of our members and safety of all state employees. But what happens with telework is it opens it up for outsourcing and having people provide services that don't live in Alaska and that can live anywhere in the world. And so we're concerned about that. We think the state needs to police what work is being done by telework and what work is being outsourced because it has significant impact on our policies and our ability to provide services. I've provided some articles about the state of Texas. They tried to outsource children's services work. I believe that those were submitted to the committee. There's an article in the public interest that I would encourage all the members to look at. It summarizes and gives you information about what happens when states try to outsource this work. It doesn't usually end well, if ever. And the motivation of public services should be serving the public and serving the public in a way to have healthy and a whole society. Public work should never be driven by profits, especially when the persons in question of receiving those services are the most vulnerable citizens, like our seniors and our children, and those Alaskans struggling with mental and behavioral health conditions. So I encourage you to look at those. We also have concerns about the logistics. A specific example includes the question of how this split will impact OCS eligibility technicians. These employees deal with both Medicaid and community services, including legal, custody and child placement issues. I think a couple of speakers have already talked about that, but it's a major issue for our members. And so that's something we think needs to be discussed. Another concern relates to OCS and coordinating with tribal governments and tribal state compact agreements, which was previously discussed. Our staff members and our union members are concerned about how this will work, since there wasn't the notice and consulting and engaging with stakeholders that needs to happen for this to work right. And, you know, again, I'm sorry that the administration wouldn't come and talk about this. I think it's, you know, part of what makes government work is when the different branches of government are talking to each other and when they're talking to the public. And I think that has to happen for this to work. It hasn't happened yet. It seems to be a done deal, and I don't think it's in the best interest of the state of Alaska when you don't engage your stakeholders and your business partners. So I think I've spoken long enough, and I'd be happy to share any additional items or concerns with committee members if they have questions. And I just want to, again, thank you very much for doing the public service of bringing this topic up for discussion and hearing from the people that are involved in this this change. And I just want to wish everybody a happy new year, and I'm available to take questions if you have them.
Great. Thank you so much for your testimony today, Mr. Metcalf, and the work that you do on behalf of Alaska's employees. Are there any questions for Mr. Metcalf at this time from committee members?
Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm just wondering, Mr. Metcalf, I know there was a lawsuit related to API and privatization. Are there other lawsuits that are active at this time related to some of these labor disputes or questionable proposals?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. We have finished up some of the litigation regarded to API, but there's still part of that case in the court system. We have ended the private contractor that came into API. That was WellPath. WellPath has left API. We still have issues at API about what they're going to do as far as management, and so we continue to watch that. There's a good organization set up within the department within the institute that is looking at how it's going to be managed. We continue to try to actively participate in that group and have done so in the past. There's other litigation involving the state and ASEA. But we look and have to police the outsourcing of work, and we have one issue going on with the Department of Health and Social Services over outsourcing COVID-related work. It's not in court, but it's within our dispute resolution process of the contract. We have to make sure the contract's followed. We would rather sit down with the state, try to work these issues out ahead of time rather than finding out about them after the fact, because that causes all kinds of costs and resource use, and it delays processes. And so from the very beginning of this administration, we have reached out and said, if you have questions or if you have ideas, we're your business partner. We need to know about them beforehand. We want you to consult us. We want you to engage us and make sure that whatever change or management decision you're making is going to be done right under our contract. We know that management has the rights to do a lot of decision making, but we always think it works better when they communicate with us ahead of time and consult with us. And it's really no different than the tribal governments. You know, we are a stakeholder and we are a business partner. And rather than tell us you're doing something after the fact, you're going to run into a lot less problems by working with us. And we want the state to operate well. We want people to have good jobs and good benefits. And we will do everything we can to work with the state to make sure that that happens. And we certainly don't ever want to get involved in litigation or the dispute resolution process, because that's just not healthy, and it's not good for the services that we provide, and it's not good for the state of Alaska. So our goal is to communicate, consult, and engage with our business partner, the state of Alaska, as much as possible. And we really, really encourage the state of Alaska to engage in that kind of process, not only with us, but with all the other stakeholders as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Metcalf at this time? Again, thank you so much for your testimony today, Mr. Metcalf. And before we expire our time together today, I wanted to check in with committee members to see if there were any follow-up questions for any of our other testifiers. All right. I do have a final question, particularly for Ms. Mativier, Chief Simon, President Peterson, or Ms. Sandoval. We focused a lot today on the discussion around impacts to child welfare, particularly Chief Simon, as an administrator of an agency that also provides health care. The other impact that we didn't really discuss today was the impact to splitting health and social services apart. And I'd be curious to hear, particularly from our child welfare advocates today, how integrated the system currently operates within Alaska, and how dividing it into two separate entities and OCS potentially into two separate entities itself would be cumbersome for individuals that you've worked with and advocated for, or just the experience that Alaskans might have. I think, Chief Simon, you touched on it a bit with the impacts to budget, where existing budget would be relocated for administrative expenses and likely lead to programs that were being cut. But I'd be curious to hear any other concerns related to splitting the division of health from family and community services. And if there's anybody who has an answer for that question or would like to type in, please just acknowledge yourself for the record.
Yes, if I may, Madam Chair, PJ Simon, Chief Chairman of Canada Chiefs Conference.
Yes, please go ahead.
Yes, we have already a difficult job of providing services for our children who we love dearly, whether anyone, right or wrong, if they great decision or a terrible decision, we provide the services that need to be addressed to take care of these kids. And I'm a firm believer, Madam Chair, in being upstream of the problem, being proactive of the problem. Most of the time, we have issues with individuals, which will lead to some issues that mental health issues, and then you're traumatized for the rest of your life. So being upstream and proactive, and the status quo, the systems in place, were well affiliated with. Like I mentioned before, I've met Cindy Lawton before, who was the director of OCS, and personally thanked her for her service to the state of Alaska and Alaskans. And furthermore, you know, when we have individuals, and we do in every village, and
if they're downstream of the problem with mental health issues, we have to send them away to the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, which is not open no more, as I understand it. I would commend the state of Alaska if they thought about, in the go forward, having an API in Fairbanks with a population of 20,000 people, the Athabascan Nation. We have about 8,000 people here in Fairbanks, and unfortunately some of them need these services. It would be help the situation tremendously if the state of Alaska build out and serves the need, the existing need of our native people who need these services, which would be a mental health facility in Fairbanks. So that's all I had to offer, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Chief Simon. Is there anyone else that would like to respond?
This is Amanda Mativier. I would like to comment.
Yes, please go ahead.
I think the larger implications of splitting the Department of Health and Social Services, and I don't know all the details of that. I've only sort of briefly looked at the separation and where each division would fall under those two new departments. And I think that, again, there's like more questions to be asked around evidence-based and how and why this would work. But public systems, when they work together, tend to do better in terms of serving families. And so, for example, for a child that's in the custody of the Office of Children's Services but is placed in a maybe therapeutic foster home with another agency that works in and builds Medicaid, that child would then be basically under the guise of two separate departments, because Medicaid is going to fall on one side and OCS is going to fall on the other. And so I think, again, in the same way that bifurcation of OCS would create complications for families in terms of communicating with public agencies, I think the same would happen at a larger scale with the split of the two departments. I think even now, with all the divisions that are within the department, they don't always all communicate so well, but enough so that families can still navigate and get through things. One example is when young people leave foster care, they're eligible if they age out of the foster care system for Medicaid up until age 26, and that's under Obamacare. And so one of the challenges for youth is often like this gap in when they leave foster care and they go apply at public assistance themselves, and there's a lap and there's all these issues with texts and things like that. Right now there's a system in place for OCS to communicate directly to public assistance. And so I don't know if things like that, like the on-the-ground sort of detail among all the divisions within the department would change, but I think it further separates like resources and supports for families. I think we should be moving toward more communication and being able to do what was said before with regard to early intervention and identifying families early. What if we, you know, like made the effort to identify all the families that are, you know, like early intervention points are things like seeing all the families that are on public assistance, that are accessing food stamps and Medicaid and housing supports. Those are the families that may eventually come on the radar of child protection. And so there's an opportunity to intervene earlier. And so it makes sense to have them all within one department. But I think, again, we're missing a lot of the information as to what this may look like in the details.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mativier, for that. Any final thoughts related to that question from testifiers?
Madam Chair, this is Tammy Sandoval, and I would agree with what Amanda just said. I recall that when I was in DHSS that we did a lot of work on confidentiality and sharing of information between divisions, and I recall that there was an opportunity to talk with other divisions about families that we shared in common, and I worry that if there were two departments that would become even more difficult. I mean, I understand that DHSS is huge, absolutely, but I think that being under one roof creates some relationships that might not otherwise be there. But mostly I think we just need to understand why it's being proposed and how the decision was made with regard to divisions, because you can think of all kinds of synergies that happen now that may not happen if the department splits into two. I just, again, worry about reorganization in general, especially right now during the pandemic. In general, in my experience, organization is messy. It's really messy, and I feel like we are already in a really messy time in our country, and I just question the timing and the information and the transparency or the lack of in terms of the decisions that are being made. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sandoval.
Madam Chair?
Yes, President Peterson.
Yes. I think I'd just reiterate that resources are already limited and difficult to access for our children and families. You know, we depend on the partnerships with public health and the Department of Behavioral Health, not only to help identify at-risk families, but also to find a way to get people the help they need. The 24/7 services often operate in crisis mode and need the prevention direct services and a direct connection to streamline services.
Speaking from experience in healthcare, I know that a lot of healthcare systems are moving into integrated models of care, wrapping services around patients, and certainly listening to everyone's testimony today, definitely hear the concern around disenfranchising Alaskans from really essential critical services that many of you advocate for and also provide in your communities. So I just really want to take a moment to say, Oyana, thank you so much for the work that you do, for your time with us this morning, and the opportunity to join us. We certainly had hoped that the department would be able to participate to answer many of these questions, but we will invite them for a future opportunity when one presents itself. The time is 11:50 a.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.